Section 2. The Rise of Terrorism. The new millennium marked a rise in terrorism, an act of violence aimed at demoralizing or intimidating others. In 2000, George W. Bush became president in an election marked by charges of voting irregularities and challenges to election results. Bush was the son of President George H.W. Bush. When the elder Bush was president, he had to deal with the United States' first military operation since Vietnam. But his son, George W., had to deal with a much more serious crisis, a devastating attack on American soil. Operation Enduring Freedom. Although there were instances of terrorism after the 1993 bomb explosion in the World Trade Center parking garage, it was an event in 2001 that changed America forever. It was 8:45 a.m. on September 11, 2001. Millions of Americans were finishing breakfast, driving their children to school, dressing for or heading to work, and either listening to the radio or watching morning TV news shows. 1 minute later, at 8:46 a.m., all that changed. News reports said that an American Airlines plane filled with passengers had flown into the North Tower of New York City's World Trade Center. Fire and thick smoke poured out of the top floors of the building. People were shocked by what they thought was a terrible accident. Minutes later, cameras caught a second passenger jet as it flew into the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. Instantly, any notion that these incidents were accidental was forgotten. The United States had been attacked, and it was not over yet. As stunned Americans watched the World Trade Center burning, American Airlines Flight 77, bound for Los Angeles, was hijacked. It left Dulles International Airport in Washington, D.C., crossed the Potomac River, and crashed into the Pentagon, the symbol of the nation's military establishment. 124 people were killed on the ground, and 76 were injured. All the passengers and crew of Flight 77 were killed. Most of the 37 passengers on a fourth flight, United Flight 93, were businessmen who left Newark International Airport at 8:41 a.m. en route to San Francisco, California. By 9:35, with the Twin Towers and the Pentagon in flames, a thickly accented voice came over Flight 93 intercom saying, "This is your captain. There is a bomb on board. We are returning to the airport." Three men had taken control of the plane. When several passengers called spouses and friends to tell them they were being hijacked, they learned of the other events of the morning. Realizing that their hijacked plane was about to be used as a weapon, a number of the passengers rushed the hijackers and the cockpit. There was silence for a few minutes, then the telephones went dead. The airplane crashed in a rural area in southwestern Pennsylvania, about 80 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, killing all aboard. No one knows the intended target of the hijackers. Possibilities include the nation's capital, the White House, or even Camp David, the presidential retreat. Whatever the terrorists had planned, the brave men and women aboard Flight 93 stopped it and, in so doing, perhaps saved hundreds of lives. At 9:59 a.m., as millions were glued to their television sets, the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed, killing those occupants still in the building and the firefighters, police officers, Port Authority officers, and rescue personnel who had been trying to save those trapped inside. 29 minutes later, at 10:28 a.m., the North Tower fell. A total of 2,774 people were killed, and over 2,000 were injured. At about 5:30 p.m., a third tower in the World Trade Center complex collapsed. The next day, another building within the complex collapsed. Immediately after September 11th, President George W. Bush declared a national emergency and called upon Congress to give him war powers. He put all the nations of the world on notice. They either supported the United States in the fight against terrorism, or they supported terrorism. Average citizens reacted in different ways. Some withdrew into the safety of their homes, wanting to be close to family and friends. Others wanted to help the victims and their families. Some stood in long lines to give blood, while others collected or donated money for the survivors of the attacks and their families. American flags became a sought-after commodity as citizens looked for ways to display their support and love for their country. The United States determined that Al-Qaeda, an extremist group of Islamist terrorists, were responsible for the September 11th attacks. Al-Qaeda was based in Afghanistan, where it was protected by the Taliban, the fundamentalist political and religious rulers of Afghanistan between 1996 and 2001. U.S. government leaders gave the Taliban an ultimatum to close terrorist training camps, hand over Al-Qaeda leaders, and return all foreign nationals who had been unjustly detained in Afghanistan. When the Taliban government refused the ultimatum, President Bush led a coalition of 70 nations in an attack on Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden's camps in Afghanistan. The operation, called Enduring Freedom, began on October 7, 2001. On December 22, 2001, America's military leaders met in the Afghan capital of Kabul for a ceremony marking the inauguration of the Afghan interim government, only 78 days after the beginning of combat operations. By the end of March 2002, the Taliban had been removed from power, and the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan had been destroyed. Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan on May 2, 2011, by a United States Special Operations military unit. The U.S. combat mission in Afghanistan continued until December 2014. At that time, most troops returned home. After 2014, the name of the operation in Afghanistan was changed to Operation Freedom Sentinel. The troops who remained were there to assist in stabilizing the Afghan government, providing training for its military, and monitoring counter-terrorist operations against the Taliban and other insurgents. President Obama predicted that all U.S. troops would be removed by 2017. President Trump changed the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan when he became president. Instead of bringing the remaining troops home in 2017, he sent more troops there. In January 2021, he began a reduction in troops to 2,500. President Joe Biden completed the withdrawal by the end of August of 2021. After the chaotic withdrawal of the U.S. military from Afghanistan, the Taliban once again ruled the country. West Virginians, as they had always done, were ready to serve the nation. 3 months after the first U.S. troops engaged in combat, some 600 West Virginians had been deployed to serve their country. By February 2022, that number had risen to 1,100, giving West Virginia the distinction of ranking third in the nation in terms of per capita active duty deployment following September 11th. The Martinsburg-based 167th Airlift Wing flew missions in Afghanistan that included transporting war detainees as well as the bodies of United States servicemen killed in action. 15 West Virginians lost their lives through August 15, 2011. America's war on terrorism involved more than just military operations. Shortly after the September 11th attack, West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd was instrumental in passing an $8.3 billion Homeland Defense Package. This money was intended to increase protection against further acts of terrorism on American soil. Even before September 11th, Senator Byrd had helped secure funding for a Homeland Defense Initiative study. The study had recommended in March 2001 that two training centers be established to address potential threats against the United States, such as airplane hijacking. One of the centers, at the National Guard's Camp Dawson near Kingwood in Preston County, was the same location West Virginia Adjutant General Allen E. Tackett proposed for a center where teams could come together to plan and participate in simulated disasters. After September 11th, more funds were allocated to the Camp Dawson project, and the first phase of its operation began in early 2002. Before September 11th, the Memorial Tunnel on the West Virginia Turnpike, which had been closed when the turnpike was upgraded to interstate standards, was converted into an anti-terrorist training center. It became part of the Center for National Response and has provided opportunities for emergency workers to be trained to locate and rescue survivors from a collapsed high-rise building, as well as from an underground parking garage where hazardous materials may be leaking. Some say this simulated site closely resembles conditions at the World Trade Center. Another step in fighting the war on terrorism was the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in 2002. Homeland Security is responsible for our nation's overall safety, including maintaining our borders and protecting critical installations at home and abroad. Funding from Homeland Security grants resulted in the creation of West Virginia Regional Response Teams. The teams, which include representatives from fire services, emergency medical services, and law enforcement, are trained to respond to all hazard and natural disaster emergencies in 6 regions across the state. The regional response teams are under the office of the state fire marshal today. Operation Iraqi Freedom. Following the attacks on September 11, 2001, the United States became more concerned about the nations that might have weapons of mass destruction that could be used by terrorists throughout the world. One such nation was Iraq. In September 2002, President Bush addressed the United Nations about the danger posed by Iraq and that country's violations of UN resolutions. In November 2002, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 1441, warning Iraq that it faced serious consequences if it continued to violate the various UN resolutions. On March 19, 2003, President Bush addressed the nation to explain that our nation was at war once again, involved in an operation that was dubbed Operation Iraqi Freedom. Wirt County resident PFC Jessica Lynch and other members of the 507th Maintenance Company were ambushed and captured outside Nazariya, Iraq on March 23, 2003. She was rescued by U.S. forces from a hospital a week later. Less than 2 months later, on May 1, President Bush declared the combat phase of the war with Iraq ended, although the Iraqis still needed our help to regain control of their country. Iraq's dictator, Saddam Hussein, was finally captured by U.S. troops in December 2003 and hanged for crimes against humanity on December 30, 2006. Although Saddam Hussein was gone and Iraq had a new government, U.S. troops remained in Iraq. The cost of supporting the continued presence of these troops in Iraq became an issue during the presidential election of 2008. The two major contenders for the Democratic nomination called for bringing the troops home, but disagreed on when that should be done. Barack Obama, who was the party's nominee and eventually elected president, favored a timeline that called for the earliest possible withdrawal of troops from a war that he believed never should have been fought. On September 1, 2010, Operation Iraqi Freedom became Operation New Dawn to reflect the reduced role U.S. troops would play in the country. President Obama announced that virtually all U.S. troops would be removed from Iraq by the end of 2011. On December 15, 2011, U.S. troops lowered the flag of command over Baghdad, officially ending the U.S. military mission in Iraq. However, U.S. troops remained until December 18, 2011. Reevaluating foreign relations. When Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, he was identified by his red baseball cap and the slogan, America First. He warned that the country was spending too much money in support of the defense of others. Trump complained that the United States had spent trillions of dollars to build a strong military to defend countries in Europe and Asia. He called for those countries to pay the cost of this defense or be prepared to defend themselves. To support his position, he reported that only 4 of the 28 members of NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, contributed the required 2% of their gross domestic product for defense. Trump repeatedly called for allied countries, including Germany, Israel, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and South Korea, to pay the United States for helping protect their nations. he suggested that his willingness to defend a country might depend on how much that country was willing to contribute to its own defense. Trump did not favor alliances that might result in our countries becoming involved in foreign affairs. He said he would not enter into any agreement that reduced the United States' ability to control its own affairs. He promoted his America First agenda by distancing the country from a number of foreign political and economic agreements. Although West Virginia is affected by all national agreements, it is affected by some more than others. After Donald Trump became president, U.S. relations with foreign countries changed. Trump seemingly preferred nations that the United States had not considered friends in the past. He praised the leaders of Russia, China, and North Korea, while distancing himself from the leaders of Germany, the United Kingdom, France, and Canada, some of the United States' strongest allies in the past. In his inaugural address, President Trump again proclaimed that his foreign policy would put America first. His opponents feared that his message meant the United States would retreat from global relationships. But even as he criticized foreign aid to defend allies, including NATO, and criticized projects like the F-35 jet fighter, he called for an increase in military spending. In fact, he increased the U.S. defense budget by $54 billion, bringing the total budget for the military to $639 billion in 2018. One of Trump's first orders as president was to withdraw the United States from the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. This agreement, aimed at slowing China's growing economic power, was signed by the United States and 11 other nations, including Japan, Canada, and Mexico, who agreed to lower tariffs among themselves. NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, was another agreement that President Trump opposed and hoped to renegotiate by the end of his first year in the White House. The agreement was introduced by President George H.W. Bush and signed into law by President Bill Clinton in December 1992. This agreement, whose purpose was to make North America more competitive in global markets, provided trade without tariffs, free trade, among Canada, Mexico, and the United States. In its 26 years of existence, it quadrupled trade among the three partners, but in the process, between 500,000 and 750,000 jobs were lost. Trump claimed the agreement had resulted in a trade deficit, buying more and selling fewer goods, resulting in less income in the United States. Meetings to revise the document began in 2017. When it appeared negotiations were moving slowly, Trump imposed a 35% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum in Canada, Mexico, and the European Union in May 2018. Canada responded by placing a tariff of $126 billion on U.S. products. In August 2018, a new agreement was finally negotiated with Mexico. On September 30, 2018, Canada reached an agreement, and the old NAFTA became the new United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. The presidents of the three countries signed the agreement on November 30, 2018. Their signatures, however, did not make the agreement binding. President Trump touted the new trade agreement as a signature accomplishment. Known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, it had to be passed by the legislatures in the three countries before it could go into effect. Mexico's legislature supported the agreement, although some members had concerns over President Trump's previous use of tariffs to coerce the country to change its border laws. Canada supported the changes. The United States legislature provided the greatest obstacle to its passage. Democratic senators raised concerns over Mexico's enforcement of labor rights and environmental law. Eventually, Congress worked through its concerns and passed the agreement. Mexico was the first country to approve the agreement, and the United States was the last. The United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement officially replaced the North American Free Trade Agreement on July 1, 2020. The new agreement created a more level playing field for American workers, including improved rules of origin for automobiles and trucks. It benefited American farmers, ranchers, and agribusinesses by modernizing and strengthening the food and agricultural trade in North America. It provided new protections and ensured opportunities for trade in the service sector. It also addressed digital trade, anti-corruption, and good regulatory practices while providing protections for small and medium-sized enterprises.